2 weeks ago, I had the unusual experience of being able to watch the Stanley Cup playoffs with a group of Brazilian church planters. Now, who watched the Stanley Cup playoffs? Do we have some hockey fans in here? Wow. The first service has more hockey fans. So maybe this will make sense, maybe it won't. When I was watching this with all these Brazilian church planters, they had never seen hockey before. And one of the challenges for them was following the puck. They were used to looking at a nice big soccer ball, and they couldn't find that puck. But what we had to do when we were explaining hockey is tell them the rules. Explain to them why they always hit each other and why they're always punching each other on the ice. And then explain, of course, how this game fits together. The most important thing we had to teach them was why, under no circumstances, they could cheer for the Boston Bruins. That was the ultimate no-no. And of course, they didn't understand why that mattered so much to me personally. And that went into an explanation of this player named Brad Marchand. If you're a hockey fan, you know what I'm talking about. And they didn't understand why I didn't like this player so much. And so I had to enlighten them. I had to teach them. So between the first and second period, I pulled out my laptop and I searched for a compilation video of his dirtiest hits. And there are many, by the way, of his dirtiest hits. And they showed scenes of him coming up behind players and going at the kneecap. They showed scenes of him slamming people to the ice after the play and notoriously licking the face of his opponent to get under their skin. Then we went into the second period, and my Brazilian friends cheered heartily for the St. Louis Blues. But I have to admit, there is a piece to me when I watch the second and third period, I wanted to see Brad Marchand get obliterated. I wanted a good Canadian player like, oh, I don't know, Ryan O'Reilly, plaster him into the boards. Am I the only one who felt this way? Now, that didn't happen. But I have been at hockey games where a dirty play was made, and then your team, the right team, the Vancouver Canucks, got back at that player. And what happens when that happens? The fans rise to their feet. They start slamming the boards and slapping their hands against the glass because they're tasting what? Sweet revenge. Then we read our passage. You have heard it said, eye for eye, tooth for tooth. But I say to you, do not resist an evil person. You have heard it said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemy and pray for those who persecute you. And most of us are like, you sure? And many people who have heard this teaching, perhaps secondhand, or know of Christians who believe in this, they say, there's no way people can live that. This is totally theoretical, high in the sky, impractical teaching. And guess what? That doesn't line up with reality. One person describes this teaching in the Sermon on the Mount as a doormat teaching, where Christians are just a doormat that people trample all over in the cruel ways of the real world. No thank you, Jesus. This isn't how things go in real life. And if you're paying attention closely to this passage, you'll know that Jesus is opening you and I and every hearer of his message to a whole new ethic, a whole new way of living that is incomprehensible unless you understand the gospel of Jesus Christ. This teaching makes no sense in our broken world unless you've encountered the evil, absorbing, grace-responding work of Jesus. And that's what we're going to open up this morning. Now, I think all of us, at least I think many of us, have enemies. We don't often call them that. We're Canadians. We're way too polite for using that word. But we have people that we really don't like. And we have people that we speak very poorly of. And we people we avoid because they have hurt us. And they are our enemies. They come in many different forms, right? We've got our political enemies. Those on the right or those on the left, wherever you align yourself, who think things and live out things that you find so frustrating and wrong. We have social enemies, people who live out of a way of life and a social life that we find very difficult. I mean, it's Pride Month right now. Think of the tension that exists between the church and the LGBTQ community. We have ethnic enemies, people from other places who live other ways of life that we find frustrating as they're in our neighborhood and changing the shape of our cities. And of course, we have family enemies. I've learned as a pastor, when you talk to people about where their hurts are and who are the people that have really made life difficult for them, they're not far away, they're not out there, they're in our homes. They live at our address, and they're related to us. And I ask you, who's coming to mind as I talk about enemies? Who are the people that you would most accurately describe as your enemy? And then more importantly, let me ask the question, how are things going with your enemy? How are you living with them? What's your way of living in that relationship? Do you retreat and avoid? Do you attack and make life horrible for them? Do you slander and gossip behind closed doors about them and build your camp and find the like-minded people who share your frustration and your dislike for that particular enemy? How do you live with your enemies? We'll come back to that. When Jesus is speaking these words on the mountain, he's speaking to a very particular group of people. This is not abstract teaching on loving your enemies. This is very concrete teaching to a very visible group of people. Jesus is teaching primarily to Jewish people, and they knew their enemy. When he says to them, love your enemy and do not retaliate, he's talking to people who hated people. And you know who they were? The Jews hated Romans. Here's why. Jews had land, Jerusalem. They had their temple where they could worship. They had their land that was governed by Jewish laws where they had the ability to live the way they saw fit. And then what happened? They got destroyed. And they got conquered by kingdom after kingdom, and now they're under the most oppressive, the most violent, which was Rome. And more than anything, the Jews hated living under oppression. And anyone who's lived in a country where they're occupied by another country understands this dynamic of being oppressed, of getting your rights taken away from you, your privileges, your sense of identity, your sense of culture, your sense of who you are, living under some foreign oppressive empire. It's tough. And Jesus knows that. He knows that most of the Jews, many of the Jews at this time, they were not sitting on the side of the mountain. They were planning revolutions against the Roman Empire. They were gathering swords and finding ways to stir up the people and kill maybe a few soldiers to get back their land, get back their privileges. So when Jesus says, love your enemies, he's talking to people who know a thing or two about hate. And so he starts by saying to them, you've heard it said, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, but I say to you, do not resist an evil person. Now that teaching, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, comes straight out of the Old Testament, and it's a good teaching. I want to emphasize that. What was happening in many ancient Near Eastern cultures, you stole something, you get killed. And when God gives his law to his Old Testament people, Israel, he says, make sure your punishment is just. Make sure it's commensurate with the crime committed. Don't overdo it. And people who would have seen Israel live out that law, they would have said, wow, that is just. And just so you know, many of our legal systems today are born out of that kind of justice, commensurate action in keeping with the crime. But now Jesus is going deeper. Just like he did with divorce and adultery and murder and the way we speak, he's driving to deeper places where he says to his disciples, his would-be followers, we can do better than that. We can do better than focusing our attention on retaliation and the measure of revenge. We can do better. He says, do not withstand, as one translation puts it. Do not take revenge. Do not get even. Do not retaliate. That's the thrust of what he's saying. And he gives four examples, right? The first example he gives is if someone insults you by slapping you. That's not very common today, but I can imagine that being very difficult to handle. The second example he gives is if someone sues you and they want your coat. Third example is someone asks you to walk a mile with their armor, and I'll get back to that in a second. And the fourth is someone's asking you for money. Now, if these are strange to you, you should know that for anyone living in the first century, these Jewish people, these were ordinary, everyday examples. Many of them were in situations where this was happening, and they could picture what it would be like to live in those illustrations. Let me focus on just one of them. And my hunch is that this is the one that grinded their gears the most. The law in Rome was that a soldier could give their equipment, all their military gear, they could give it to any citizen and force them to walk with that equipment for a mile. And in my imagination, I can picture Roman soldiers who love keeping these Jews under their oppression, delighting in handing over their equipment, their chest piece, all their work, and saying, walk. And I can picture the Jewish people who hated the Roman soldiers the most, hating every second of that walk as they carry, by law, these pieces of military equipment. And if you can imagine that, imagine hearing Jesus say, walk 2 miles. Voluntarily. Surprise them. Be creative with them. Subvert this whole system of how revenge could go and surprise them and confront them with a new kingdom ethic that doesn't operate on their scales, that doesn't work the way they think it should work because it operates on kingdom scales. And citizens of the kingdom, as Jesus will say in so many different ways in Matthew, is loving the Father with our whole hearts and loving our neighbor as ourselves. And as he teaches in so many ways throughout Matthew, guess who your neighbor is? It's the Roman soldier. It's the prostitute. It's the tax collector. It's the poor. It's the disadvantaged. Those people you love with a generous, surprising, careful, patient love. Subvert their system. Surprise them with a whole new way of living. Do not retaliate. That's a hard teaching. Think about your own life. Think about what that could possibly look like in your circumstance. Change the scales. Confront them with the life of the kingdom. Now, I want to give you an example of this because it's important that we can at least give a sense of what it could look like today. I want to introduce you to a little boy in grade 4 named Ben. Ben Goheen is his name, and he's our cellist. Where are you, Ben? You're right there. He's annoyed that I'm telling the story. Not once, but twice. When Ben was in grade 4, there was another boy in his school named Ben also, and that Ben picked on this Ben. And he made life difficult for Ben. He would mock him, he'd tease him, and Ben would come home to his parents, Mike and Marnie. He would say, there's this kid at school, and he's being mean to me. He's teasing me, he's making life hard for me. And his parents, you know, thoughtfully, patiently, kind of coaching Ben on how they could handle him in hopes that the teacher would intervene. And this kept going. This boy eventually started bullying him more aggressively, and he's being rough with Ben. And Ben came home, and he said to his parents again, this boy, Ben, he's still bullying me. And so Mike, Ben's dad, did what many dads would do. And he says, okay, Ben, come into the living room. Hit me. And he started showing Ben how to hit him back and how to hold him and slam him to the ground and all these little self-defense measures. It was like Karate Kid in the living room of the Goheen house. And he says to Ben after it's all done, when that Ben goes after you, you take him down. You beat him up and you let him know he can't mess with my boy. Any dads understand that propensity? So Ben goes back to school with his tricks, his fights, and they don't hear much after that. It's pretty quiet for the rest of the year. And then Mike and Marnie get invited to an end-of-year celebration. And this little boy runs up to them. And he says to them, hi, are you Ben's parents? They look at him and say, yep. He's like, I'm Ben. I'm Ben's best friend. Mike and Marnie look at him. They look at each other like. So they go home and they say to Ben, there's a boy that came up to us. He said his name is Ben. He's your best friend. Is that the boy who's picking on you? And Ben said, yes, yeah, that's Ben. And in incredible grade 4 wisdom beyond his years, he said, you know, I learned that he was really lonely. And he was picking on people because he had no friends. And so I decided to be nice to him and become his friend. And in that very moment, I could just picture Mike's mind going, pfft. Here I wanted you to beat the daylights out of him. And what he really needed was a friend. And that small story is a beautiful illustration of absorbing evil and responding with grace. And there's a tendency, and I have to admit, this was true in my own heart when I heard this, to say, well, that could well work for grade 4 boy to another boy who's picking on him in a small scale, but that's not going to work with my coworker. That's not going to work with a person who's really hurt me in deep ways in my family. And I want to ask you this, are you sure about that? Are you sure that this illustration of Ben in grade 4 isn't exactly what might be needed with our enemies? Couldn't it be possible that the person who's been wounding us, the people who have hurt us the most, that they're living in a cycle of wounding, then wounding more, being hurt, then hurting others, and living on the cycle of revenge, and they are hungry and thirsting to see someone who finally doesn't live in that cycle of revenge, who can actually absorb evil and return it with good and change the whole playing field? And could it be that if you live that way with your enemy, it might be the first time your enemy has ever seen a small embodiment of the gospel of Jesus Christ? Let that sink in. Jesus continues this radical teaching in the second section where he says, you have heard it said, love your neighbor, hate your enemy. And by the way, that quote is not in the Old Testament. The quote, hate your enemy, is nowhere in the scriptures. And it's likely that in the tradition of the Jews at that time, who were living in a great deal of hate, they were sort of building up this sense of like, you can love Jews, but hate Gentiles. Hate the Romans. They're our enemies. And Jesus says, oh no. Even in oppression, you love your enemies. And you pray for those who persecute you. What I love about this section of the scriptures is that Jesus gives us a really clear reason why. Listen to what he says. Pray for those who persecute you, that you may be children of your Father in heaven. He, the Father, causes his Son to rise on evil and the good. He sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. Are you hearing that? Jesus is describing the character of his Heavenly Father. He says, when God blesses people, he doesn't just bless the people who are righteous. When he sends rain for the farmers, he doesn't just pick the righteous farmers and just bring one cloud of rain. He only sends it to BC. I don't know why that is. God blesses people, even those who run from him, even those who sort of reject him and live a whole different life. He gives them the gift of provision and blessing. He doesn't have to do that. You know, 2 weeks ago, I was in Brazil and I got the opportunity to go to Rio for a day and a half. I was on study leave. I know what you're thinking. What kind of study leave brings you to the beaches of Rio? Well, it's not so bad. But I was there in the late afternoon, early evening, and there's people all over this beach. And it's the most beautiful beach I've ever been to. We've got beaches here in Vancouver. They got nothing on Rio. Even Diego, I was talking with him, and he said, Rio is the most beautiful place. So there's all these people playing. They're eating. The families are sitting on the beach. There's kids in the water still. And they're playing this, I've never seen it, but it's volleyball with feet. What's that called? Foot volley. Thank you. Diego knows. And it was just it's this beautiful scene where the sun's going down. People are enjoying this beautiful scene. And maybe because I'm a pastor, but this is the thought that popped into my mind. I thought to myself, does anyone know that all of this is a gift? Do any of these people playing these games, enjoying this sun, seeing this view, watching the mountains, do they know that this is a gift from the Father? And are they going to go home and say to one another, God is so good? And the answer that came into my heart was, no. Not very many people are doing that. And yet God still allows them to enjoy the incredible beauty of Rio. He doesn't have to do that. And we get just a small piece of God's character when we look at all the beauty and provision and goodness he gives to unrighteous people. His patience with people who reject him. Present company included. You could summarize the whole story of the Bible as a story of an enemy-loving father. From the beginning, God creates this beautiful, good world, places humanity within it to enjoy it, to enjoy him through it. And what do? They reject him. They doubt his goodness. They live life on their own, and sin enters the world. In that moment, sin starts corrupting relationship, corrupting friendship. There's murder, there's death, there's hatred, there's pride, there's all the works. And God, in that moment, could have said, that's it. I don't need this. But instead, he sets on the long road of redemption. The long road of making it right. The long road of bringing healing and restoration. And the whole story of the Old Testament is God binding himself in relationship. I mean, binding himself to people who run and reject his law and chase after other gods, who can't speak, they can't heal, they don't talk. And yet he over and over again forgives them, heals them, extends grace, because he's committed to restoration. He's committed to turning enemies into friends, into neighbors, into children. And the climax of history and of the biblical story, when Jesus enters our reality to be seen, to be heard, to be watched, the fullest revelation of God, this is the picture we get. A man who is rejected by his own people, by Judas. He's beaten and mocked by the Romans, the people in power. He's stripped of all of his authority on earth. He's stripped of all of his dignity. He's hung up on the Roman death machine, that is the cross. And there he is, hanging in blood with a crown of thorns, totally humiliated before all the people watching. And he could have, if he wanted, just spoken his words and destroyed his enemies. He had that kind of power. In fact, when Satan was tempting Jesus, that's what the temptation was. Call on your legion of angels, Jesus. And he withholds. And what are the words that come out of his mouth? Father, forgive. And in that moment, we get right to the center of this ethic that Jesus doesn't just speak, but he embodies. When they strip him of everything, when they whip him for unjust things, when they send him up on this Roman death machine, all of it wasn't fair. And what he does in that climactic moment in history is absorbs the evil and responds to that evil with good. His words over his creation are, "Father, forgive." That's the center of our ethic. Not just spoken, but embodied by King Jesus, who shows us how to do it in his own life, his own death, and his own resurrection. One of the beautiful things about being a pastor is that this becomes less and less theoretical as I get to know my church. And I've seen people in Hope Community Church who get to receive that enemy-loving power of God, who wrestle in prayer to say, is that really for me? Is God really making me from enemy into neighbor into child? And the answer is yes. And I've seen hearts turn from cold and hard and hateful to soft and gracious and loving through the power of Jesus Christ and the indwelling work of the Holy Spirit. I've seen it. And nothing is more beautiful and salty than when the church begins to live as that countercultural, salty, enemy-loving community. Let me read for you a quote that comes from Dale Bruner. I love this quote. What makes Christians salty and different and useful in the meat of the world is they're breaking the world's code of love for love, good for good, evil for evil reciprocity. It is Christians' countergrain, countercultural love for the undeserving, the unloving, and even the positively hostile that makes them recognizably Christian. So let me ask you again. Do the enemies in your life, the political, the social, the ethnic, the familial, do they see us as embodying the enemy-loving heart of our Father? How are we living that out before them? And could it be that as we take steps towards that, we will embody in our own small way the very love of Jesus Christ extended through the cross? Now, I'm the first to admit that this teaching is so counterintuitive. And I'm always surprised at how fickle I am in my own life when I'm hurt in small ways and how quickly I can begin to hate. And imagine saying horrible things to people who've hurt me in small ways. And I think, what about the real enemies? The real hurt? How do we do this? And I think that Jesus gives us really practical advice even in this passage. You ready for it? I say to you, love your enemies and what? Pray for those who persecute you. It seems to me in my own journey, and I've heard this from other people, the first step towards really loving an enemy is praying for them. Something changes in us when we hold that person, that community before the Father in prayer, and we ask that his heart becomes our heart for those people. That we learn to see those enemies through the lens of his creation, through the lens of his love, through the lens of his compassion over all that he has made. And slowly but surely, as we hold these people in our prayer, God's own heart becomes our heart. The Spirit softens our heart towards enemies, and we begin to take the journey of loving those people, drawing near to those people in grace, creatively finding ways to not retaliate, but absorb that evil and return the good. What I want to do to finish my sermon is lead us in a prayer. I'm going to pray for whoever our enemies might be, and then I'm going to leave a space where we can pray and be honest with the Father about those particular relationships. The worship team is going to come up and they'll finish the prayer by leading us in a song called Instruments of Your Peace. And few songs capture what we're called to be like that song. Allow it to minister. And if you need to keep praying while that song goes, that's fine. Allow it to minister to you in your prayer. Join me as we pray.